I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, the 2016 race was roiled by the announcement that former GOP nominee and 2012 loser Mitt Romney was, against all logic, getting his band back together to mount yet another run for the White House. This has baffled everyone, including the Huffington Post's Amanda Turkle, who joins us to form a chorus of confused noises. Elsewhere, the past few weeks has seen the age-old battle between Wall Street and Main Street re-enjoined, with American taxpayers facing the prospect of the Volcker Rule getting delayed. But the spines of the Democratic minority have suddenly stiffened. We'll talk about why. And finally, President Barack Obama is pitching a plan to reform paid family leave for federal workers. We'll discuss the implication of this plan and its potential to spur similar reforms elsewhere. I'm Jason Linkins, joined as always by Arthur Delaney and Zach Carter. You know, this year's Oscars are so white that a lot of people are going to confuse it for the Davos Economic Forum. But here's what happened first. Hey, welcome. We're back for another week of So That Happened. Joining me, as always, we have...
Zach Carter, our senior political economy reporter for the Huffington Post.
And we have...
Arthur Delaney.
That's good. I'm Jason Linkins. How's your week been?
My week's been really, really hectic. I've been stunned at how maybe it's just because, you know, when Congress is out, it was the holidays and there wasn't a whole lot of stuff going on. And I'm just the fact that I have to work now is making a normal workload feel impossible. But I have felt like that things have been really going crazy this week.
You're getting
week.
The pit sweats again.
Yeah. I'm getting the scoop sweats. You know how scoops. If you eat like a lot of processed meats, you get that weird meat sweat.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm getting the sweats from you know, just covering Congress.
Arthur, you're still deeply, deeply, deeply upset at the accolades that the movie Boyhood is piling up. Boyhood, still great film, but Boyhood, apparently.
The accolades were predictable. What's been frustrating is just the constant gushing by losers who think Boyhood is such a good movie, which it's not.
Boyhood is a great movie.
I've not seen it. You're a warhorse, man. So,
warhorse. The warhorse horse.
Give me back my warhorse. No, I know you're a big warhorse man. I saw Birdman. That was good, right?
Is it a movie called Birdman, or does it actually have some really pretentious title with parentheses?
It has a real it's Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
Man, trash bin. Not going to see a movie with parentheses in the title.
Arthur?
What is this, an art house?
For people who are not aware, Arthur's favorite movie is Jurassic Park 3.
Rough week for John Boehner. He was, rough week for the crazy...
Every week is a rough week for John Boehner because he has to deal with all of the clown bags in the Republican Congress.
Yeah, John Boehner didn't have it easy.
Now he has to deal with a clown bag bartender, and that's like his people, okay?
Yeah, this
bartender's is Boehner's people.
Fired country club bartender in Ohio had a plot to kill Boehner, but really, it's just a crazy guy.
It's like something out of a Coen Brothers movie, which again, I'm sure you hate, Arthur.
No, I like Coen Brothers. Okay. Films.
Hudsucker proxy.
Yeah, I can't believe this. I can't believe that happened. Obviously, we're against poisoning John Boehner.
Yeah, don't poison people.
This is why they have their own police force, and why high-ranking members like John Boehner have even additional security detail, because public officials like that face near constant threats from lunatics, and this happens, I think, more than people realize, but. It was a crazy guy. It's not like ISIS or something had an actual actionable plot to kill him.
Right, it was some country club bartender.
Still, a guy who thought he was Jesus. You know, he was nuts.
Yeah, and it was over like Ebola or something. It was not.
Yeah, he accused.
He got the politics wrong and blamed John Boehner instead of Barack Obama for Ebola. You got that wrong. It was Obama's fault.
Sorry, crazy guy.
For the Ebola outbreak that did not happen in the United States.
Go back to the nut house, crazy man. Yeah, okay.
Mental health advocates are going to love us for that.
Okay, joining us now is Amanda Turkle. Amanda, what's your title?
I guess just politics reporter.
Just politics reporter.
That's fine.
Okay, so I'm here. We're now joined with just politics reporter Amanda Turkle, and we're going to talk about probably one of this year's already, like, the biggest pressing conundrums in politics, which is what is going on with Mitt Romney, right?
What are we going to do with Mitt Romney?
How do you solve a problem like Mitt Romney? For those of you who don't know, Mitt Romney is a guy who ran for president a couple times and lost in 2012. Now I'm really treating you people like you don't know anything. But he was well and considered like out of politics, you know, until last Friday, where he suddenly decided, hey, I'm back in this. I'm talking to my people, my big donors, my elite supporters, and we're going to make a run. What the fuck?
Well, I think that there are two theories. There's the one that is a lot more crass, and it's just that Mitt Romney needs to feel relevant. He needs to be in the conversation. So he might not really run, but at least now people are talking to him and paying attention to him again. So that's one. I don't know if I actually believe that. What I actually think is happening is Mitt Romney believes the country needs him, that this is his calling. This is his destiny. He is, you know, the White House has his name written all over it. And that just he believes that he can actually make a difference in the country, whether or not the country wants him. And I think he believes that deep down people do want him.
So there's cynical interpretation of both of those. I mean, those are both basically Mitt Romney feeling like he is important and he is the answer.
I kind of feel your second explanation to be the more crass one.
Yeah.
Because the rationale for Romney in 2012 was that we are in the midst of a bad economy, and he felt that he had the economic nous to get us out of that, and also the technocratic skill to run the government on top of that. Now, in the ensuing months after the election, there were things that maybe would have proven the second part true. It's most notably the bungled rollout of the healthcare.gov website. But what we have now is a situation where the economy is improving. It's actually improving beyond the parameters and conditions that he promised in his campaign. Mm-hmm. And the website's working fine. And maybe there's some foreign policy things where he has like a legit beef with. But if America needed him when the economy is bad, why do we need him when the economy is good?
Mitt Romney believes that America is still not on the right direction. Basically, that is how I'm sort of trying to get into Mitt Romney's mind. And he's been surrounded his whole life by people tell him he's destined for greatness, that he is the smartest man in the room. And he has absorbed a lot of that. He obviously had a very famous, prominent father who was widely respected. And I think a lot of that sort of rubbed off on Mitt Romney and how he thinks about himself and his family. And I believe that Mitt Romney actually does want to help the country. He actually values public service. But you know, I don't go around the country and hear people saying what we need now is Mitt Romney.
So what precipitated the Romney boomlet that we are now living in was Jeb Bush.
Right.
Calling donors and announcing, you know, I am really going to consider doing this.
Right.
Not actually that I am doing it, but, you know, at this stage, the custom is to say I will consider running for president.
Yeah, and at the point that Bush got to before Romney started messing about was that I wasn't yet to the point where I really believed Jeb was serious either. And it seems to me like now suddenly there's just so much creatine in the water, everyone's going nuts. Like Rand Paul's making like statements criticizing people. Chris Christie's made orations now that sort of put him in that presidential milieu. It seems to me like now we've catalyzed this weird chemical reaction in 2016. Everyone's nuts again.
But Amanda, why would the Jeb Bush toe dipping be what makes Romney jump in.
Yeah.
What? Because I agree. That's weird.
They are both, you know, dynastic. They're both rich.
Yeah.
They're both former governors. And they're both relatively moderate. So why would Romney see Jeb Bush and be like, well, you know what? We need two of those in this race.
And maybe he was jealous for the attention. But right, they are competing for the same donors, the same advisors, and sort of the same slice of the electorate. I think Romney may have more of a problem in that he really, I don't really know what he represents other than corporations on Wall Street, but other than being sort of the anti-Obama. Whereas Jeb Bush does have his own distinct identity, whether it's on immigration. He has stood by Common Core. He is presenting his own brand of Republicanism, whereas I don't really, I mean, Mitt Romney changes so often. I have really no idea what he'll do or he'll be.
You just identified probably the two things about Jeb Bush that would likely like go over like a lead balloon.
Right,
with
doom
the
him in the primary.
And, but it's weird because my read, and maybe I'm completely wrong on this, but my read coming out of the election was that the hardcore conservative voters that we call the GOP's base kind of grudgingly accepted that Mitt Romney was going to be their nominee in 12. The same way they grudgingly accepted that John McCain was going to be their nominee in 08. And I don't think that the base ever really saw either of those two guys as like being of them. And it seems to me that there was a clamoring for someone way more conservative, way more rock-ribbed to be the nominee in 16 from the GOP base. And it's so for that reason alone, it's weird that Jeb Bush was just like, I got this. But now that Romney is like, well, I got this too. It's just like, don't you guys feel like you're the last two people that right now the GOP primary voters want to vote for?
And there's a good chance that if this field had been stronger the last time around, Romney would not have gotten the nomination.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
This time their field, they do seem to have more options, at least initially. You know, there's Rand Paul, who is desirable to a lot of people, who knows what Ted Cruz is going to do. So there's a good chance they won't even get through the primary. I'm not surprised that Jeb Bush jumped in. I do think there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who are a little frustrated with the direction it's going and see him as a viable alternative. But I mean, I thought Romney was very smart when he said, no way, I'm just going to return to my rich life, be happy with my nice family, yeah, and just live a really great life. But I guess, I don't know.
And this whole time he has been doing that. If you go on Twitter, you can see and just, you know, search Mitt Romney airport. People have been seeing him at the airport like every week and taking pictures with him.
He's been eating sandwiches, trying new sandwiches.
Yeah, he doesn't look unhappy.
Of course not.
So it's surprising that this is happening. I think what Jeb and Romney both bring to the table here, advantages they both have over many more conservative contenders. Well, it's really one thing, money.
Right.
They are both rich. Neither of them do anything. You know, they're not currently in the Senate like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, for example. And they're close to the people who will dump money into the campaigns. So what? But that, I mean, that's that really, I don't see how that gets them over the bar. And that's why I think, because that's the only thing that they really have going for them. The Jeb Bush Romney moment we're in right now won't last for a long time.
Maybe I'm remembering this incorrectly, but wasn't there a time when Mitt Romney actually sort of like critiqued the potential of a Jeb Bush campaign along the lines of, well, he's going to have some of the same problems I did because, you know, he's associated, yes, with Wall Street too. And so then Romney's solution to that is like, well, I'll get in. It's like really weird. It's like, so now we have two people with your problems, including you, the guy with the problem.
It makes no sense at all. I was just as shocked as everyone else when Mitt Romney said he was jumping in. We're trying to figure it out. But honestly, I don't understand why he's doing this. It doesn't make sense. I would assume that Mitt Romney would rather have Jeb Bush as the nominee than, say, Ted Cruz or, yeah, Rand Paul. And so what is he doing? You know, maybe they won't split the vote. Maybe they will. But it does not seem to be – he is not helping Jeb Bush by this.
So the economy is no longer locked in a crate on the roof of America's car and drizzling diarrhea down the back windshield.
Thanks for working.
We no longer need Mitt Romney to pull America over and hose down the economy so that we can resume
Thank you
driving to Canada.
Thank you for working Seamus into the discussion.
But here's one thing that is very different about Mitt Romney, something that he has to offer that he didn't in 2012. And that is, I believe he has been paying taxes this whole time.
Oh, that's right.
Since 2012, he has filed tax returns. He probably donated hefty sums to charity. And he hates to brag about that kind of thing, but you know, when the tax returns come out, that will be reflected. So he won't have to brag about his charitable side. So I wonder if that's one thing. This is ridiculous. No one's going to.
And didn't Jeb Bush already say he will release his tax returns?
Tons of tax returns. So many tax returns.
And he's been doing an absurd number of financial transactions. So that is another dreadful similarity between Jeb and Mitt. What a strange Republican primary.
And the other thing is, healthcare is not the main issue anymore. And that was something that Romney really had going for him. I'm the guy who can fix healthcare, and that's gone. That's not the main issue.
We've got terror in a bigger way now than we did. And we had a Romney associate saying, if President Romney had been in charge, there would be no ISIS right now. How strong, Amanda, is the terror argument that I'm Mitt Romney and I'm going to, stop the terrorists?
I mean, it's very, if I were president, we would have world peace. See, it's really easy to say.
if I were president, but everyone would have two puppies.
I mean, this is why Obama won. The country trusted him that this was a new course in foreign policy. America wasn't going to be hated around the world. He wasn't going to get us into wars. But the world is a messy place. The president of the United States can't control everything, and maybe he shouldn't. And foreign policy has at times been pretty tough for Obama. So, yeah, it's great for Romney to say that. That's nice. But we would see what happened. I mean, first of all, ISIS was not created by Obama. The seeds were planted, back when we invaded Iraq. So it's not all Obama's fault. And I don't think the world would be this big, happy place if Romney were president.
But it sounds like now the argument here is that, Romney wouldn't have retreated, cut and run from Iraq so quickly. So things wouldn't have festered in that region to the point where
perhaps he would have engaged more with the Iraqi government than Obama did.
Yeah.
There's plenty of arguments. There's so many ways you can armchair quarterback foreign policy. And I think that it kind of leads you down a lot of blind paths. But at the same time, foreign policy, I don't think was that key an issue in 12.
No.
Yeah. It may be in 16. But if it is, it's because the economy has rafted itself back to a safer place. So it's I guess now is the time for Romney to step out and maybe prove what he's been talking about all along. But it's going to be in mid conditions.
And that's where Republicans will have a really interesting discussion if Rand Paul runs versus some of these more Rand Paul versus John Bolton. Let's watch those debates. That'll be fun. But the Republican Party will have a really, really fun time with trying to figure out where it's going on foreign policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that for the moment, we just embrace the confusion that is Mitt Romney making a very puzzling decision to run for president again. Okay. Well, Amanda, thanks for joining us to talk about this predicament we're in.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess while we're on the subject of country clubs, how's the country club set doing, Zach Carter?
Well, according to Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of the nation's largest bank, JP Morgan Chase.
Is he the one doing God's work, or is that?
It's Lloyd Blankfein, who's CEO of Goldman Sachs, which has gold in the name. So it's
Dimon
shinier.
Is the one with the gorgeous head of hair.
Yeah. Diamond's the attractive one, the one who was once rumored to be, and I thought it was a little bit of a joke, potential Treasury Secretary nominee for Barack Obama. He was once a high flyer in Democratic Party sort of politics.
That is a good joke.
And he would be the Treasury Secretary if it weren't for you crazy kids and that dog of yours.
That's right. He would.
Second, I operate the mystery machine.
We figured out that he was actually just wearing a sheet over his head. He wasn't really a ghost.
So he just wants the mill for himself. Okay.
So Jamie Dimon is saying that banks are under assault at J.P. Morgan's earnings call the other day, and which is it's in a sense true for J.P. Morgan because J.P. Morgan keeps doing things that appear to violate lots of laws. So they've been They've been written up. They've had to settle for allegedly rigging energy markets for consumers in California and I believe Michigan. You know, they've had all sorts of problems with mortgages, that with both the securities they sold to investors, which were much worse than what they said.
All right,
they
what were the earnings on
blah,
this
blah,
call?
Blah, blah, blah. Point is, he said they were under
assault. What were the earnings?
I don't even, who cares?
It was like $4 billion.
They made tons of money, yeah. It was like $900 million less than the same quarter last year, so they only made like $4 billion instead of $6 billion.
They're so under assault.
Or $5 billion. So, you know, they're super under assault.
Like that.
And what's interesting is that while this is while they're only making billions of dollars and not more billions of dollars, J.P. Morgan Chase is sort of at the center of a bill that the first thing that that House Republicans decided to bring up in the new Congress, one of the first bills at least, which would delay large portions of the Volcker Rule, which is a key part of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act, focused on some risky securities that J.P. Morgan Chase happens to hold $30 billion of. So while they're being assailed, the Congress is also actively trying to just hand them another favor.
Now, this was a line of discussion after – in the end of the last Congress when Elizabeth Warren and Democrats rebelled against the same thing, right? A Volcker rule delay.
Well, related, but not
a similar
quite the
type
same,
of yeah. thing. The same Wall Street reform bill from 2010.
Right.
Which continues to be implemented.
And Democrats are making a lot of hay over this tactic because the truth is, for a lot of 2013 and 2014, a lot of House Democrats actually signed up with Republicans to chip away at some very important. And some-
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Not so important parts of Dodd-Frank.
Yeah.
And the Volcker Rule is a pretty important part. The thing that was packed into the Cromnibus was called – has the really glorious and sexy name of swaps pushout. But it basically says that banks can't sell risky derivatives from a unit that's insured by
taxpayers. The rule is that you must push out your swaps.
Yep.
And the thing in the bill – last year was a pushing out of the swaps push out rule.
You could pull them back in.
It's just like a great name for an old timey baseball player. Right. Yeah, swaps push out takes it yard.
It looked like
good old swaps doing it again.
Who's on first?
Yeah. So swaps push out, that all happened. They repealed the swaps push out as part of the Cromnibus, and everybody said, well, you know, you can't just slip these things into these big must pass bills. And so there really aren't any big must pass bills this time around, you know, this month, because Congress is just settling in. There are no critical deadlines. The government's not going to shut down.
So these are like the usual pot shots that we've become familiar with from House Republicans.
And it's like an 11-point bill. And there's a bunch of stuff in there that Democrats would vote for and probably not catch too much flack from financial reformers. Some of the stuff in there they would definitely catch flack from financial reformers on. But the Volcker Rule thing is a big deal.
So Democrats held the line on soft push out.
They held together. They almost brought down.
They almost brought it down.
Brought down the funding bill entirely. So there were something like 60 votes for swaps pushout. And I think something that really worried financial reformers was that right after that happened, there was a lot of press about how Wall Street had pushed too far and that Republicans had gone too far. And the Democratic leadership didn't know what they were doing and had no idea how badly they defended their base. And that as a result of swaps pushout, there weren't going to be any more of these sneak attacks on financial reform. Well, the first thing that happens when Republicans come to Congress, it's like, here's an 11-point bill, and point 11 is pretty bad attack on financial reform.
But wait, Zach, this isn't a must-pass legislation. It's not hitching a ride on government funding.
Right.
Sure, there's a Republican Senate. Could it get through the Republican Senate without a Democratic filibuster?
Well, that's the thing. None of these bills that passed in 2013 and 2014 could get through the Senate because Harry Reid just didn't put them on the floor. So we haven't actually had any real test of how serious the Democratic resistance would be on the Senate side. On the House side, it's been pretty flabby. I mean, there were a lot of House Democrats who changed their votes this time around from voting on a very similar 11-point package in September, which had gone about 50-50 on Democrats. This time around, only 35 Democrats voted for it. So you had over 150 Democrats voting against it. And that was a significant change, because if you had had a huge showing of Democrats coming out in support of this, it would have sent a signal to Wall Street lobbyists. One, you didn't overreach in December. Everybody's still down with doing favors for you in Capitol Hill. And two, hey, Senate, this is not controversial. Democrats like this on the other side. You are not going to take a whole lot of flack for voting for this stuff. And that would have put pressure on Barack Obama to sign this thing into law as a bipartisan bill. So I think as a result of last week's vote, which Democrats actually killed the bill, they actually brought it down because House Republicans had brought it up under a procedure called suspension of the rules, meaning Democrats couldn't offer any amendments, but they would need a two-thirds majority vote. Because they brought it down under those circumstances, the House Republicans then just brought it up again this week. And even fewer Democrats voted for it, only 29.
Wow.
So you clearly see the Democratic Party sort of organizing around the idea that, and I think learning some lessons from 2014 and the results of that election, they don't want to be identified as a party of Wall Street at a time when a lot of people in the economy aren't doing so well.
All right. So does Jamie Dimon have a veto-proof
majority
for this legislation in the House and Senate? Or if the White House does what Barack Obama has threatened to do and whips out the veto pen on some of this, not urgent, not must pass deregulation, would Republicans then be able to kick Obama's butt and override the veto?
Seems not.
It appears not. Right, because the first bill failed. You need a two-thirds majority in order to.
That's an example right there with that suspension vote. We saw that they can't get above this veto line.
But also, it's worth remembering that Obama didn't threaten to veto the legislation until after Democrats had brought it down.
Ding dong.
So there is a lot of signaling going on between different chambers of Congress and different branches of government among Democrats right now. They're really trying to sort out what they're going to do with all of this Wall Street policy. And I think it's significant. There's a reason why Republicans put it back on the floor after they knew they couldn't get the veto-proof majority, because they can't. It becomes very difficult to slip this sort of thing into a must-pass piece of legislation later on if it actually had failed before. Even if it had failed under the two-thirds vote, Democrats could say, "Hey, no, we defeated that. We defeated that legislation. This next time around, if we get to the debt ceiling or something, Republicans can say, well, this did at least pass, and we'll see how strong Obama's resolve is under those types of circumstances, or if we see a repeat of basically the Cromnibus vote." There's also this other guy, Antonio Weiss, who Obama had nominated to a Treasury, who is not going to have that job now. This is a very interesting Wall Street week.
So, Zach.
Arthur.
There is this line of thinking that in this messaging war, the Wall Street efforts of Republicans and acquiescence of Democrats is kind of prodding this sleeping giant that is Elizabeth Warren.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of that? Is she becoming more powerful?
Is she the Kraken? Have we unleashed the Kraken?
I think there are two different.
Please answer the question in terms of Krakens.
Yeah. So there are two different Kraken-like issues here as relates to Elizabeth Warren. One is the fact that most of this drama over the Volcker rule took place in the House. And Elizabeth Warren really, I don't think, had a tremendous amount of influence over that. But at the same time, there was a fellow named Antonio Weiss, who was an investment banker at Lazard who specialized in corporate tax inversions, which is the sneaky little trick where you just buy a company that's in another country to change your address for tax purposes and then lower your American tax bill. He's a big, big Democratic Party donor, gives to all sorts of things.
Huge. Also, he's the publisher of the Paris Review.
Yeah.
So he's fancy.
He's intellectual, liberal elite gazillionaire. And he gives a lot of money to the Democratic Party. But Elizabeth Warren was like, why would we nominate this guy to the number three position at Treasury where he's supposed to? It would be undersecretary for domestic finance. It's the person who's basically in charge of managing the American government's debt. And he doesn't have any experience managing that type of that type of operation. And, he's an investment banker who works on mergers and tax deals.
Worse, he was going to be paid a retention fee from Lazard, which is
wasn't it like $20 million?
Yes,
and a lot of money.
Yeah, retention fee is the type of thing you give a guy when you're saying, "Could you please stay at our company?" And they say, "Yeah, okay, for $20 million, I'll stay." They were going to give him $20 million to go work for the government. Which
specifically
made it pretty difficult to discern whether he'd ever not be Lazard's man at Treasury.
It was to not work for another bank, which includes the government.
Right. You know, so yeah. Great. So do you love your country? If you love your country, turn down the $20 million, bro.
It was
so he's still getting that.
Of course.
Yeah. And here's what's interesting though. Elizabeth Warren cried foul on this and Weiss could not get through in 2014. And so then Obama renominated him this year. And after a few days, Weiss submitted his desire to be withdrawn from consideration, which usually means the administration told him to submit that letter. So the Obama administration gave up on it and said, you know what, we don't want to have a long drawn out nomination fight.
There having been no real rationale for his nomination in the first place.
All right. So long story short, to answer Jason's question, yes, Elizabeth Warren is the Kraken.
But also... there are a lot of other Krakens that are rising in other parts of the Democratic Party in Washington. It's not just Elizabeth Warren's party. There are a lot of other like-minded people. It's become sort of a central tenet of the Democratic Party in Washington that you can't just do favors for Wall Street for fun anymore.
Now, Arthur, we wanted to talk about what's going on in the wide world of Main Street policy, paid family leave.
The White House this week, I was kind of surprised. Valerie Jarrett took to LinkedIn to make a major policy announcement.
On LinkedIn.
Right. And
so that's a thing now.
Well, I checked my spam filter, so I fortunately caught the email. And they are going to... make a big push for paid family leave. And it's going to start with an executive action that will give federal workers at least 6 weeks of parental leave after the birth of a child.
So you get six. Is this just for women, or does it apply to men as well?
It's to both women and men. So here, a little background information. The United States is the only rich country that doesn't guarantee paid maternity leave or paternity leave when you have a kid. For all the talk
about
family values, having a kid in the United States often means you will suffer economic punishment if you want to raise your child.
Can we just emphasize though that babies really are totally moochers? They do not contribute at all.
I have seen so many babies sucking at the teats of their moms.
Babies are selfish. It's absolutely a fact. So
yeah.
So anyway, the White House. This is what they're doing in their sort of lame duck minority situation with Republicans completely controlling Congress, and that is because this is a broadly popular issue, not just with Democrats, not red meat to the base.
Right.
It's something that everyone agrees with because it's logical. Because how are you supposed to raise your children if you lose your job immediately upon
having a child?
Having children.
It's pretty difficult.
Existing policy, if you work at a big company, you can get 12 weeks of unpaid leave. That's the Family Medical Leave Act. And that's the law, and they have to let you come back.
Right.
But, you know, as to how well that works... I don't think most people would agree it works all that well. About 11% of the private workforce does have access to some kind of paid family leave. For instance, we at the Huffington Post have a relatively generous paid family leave policy.
Thank you, Ryan and Ariana.
Yay.
Buy AOL stock.
One of our bosses, Kate Palmer, was just took a couple months off.
Oh, come on, man!
Yeah. Here, Arthur, forgot about that. Yeah.
So it's great,
Jack Arthur. Delaney, welcome to the world.
So having and this is catching on a little bit, like the minimum wage did. For instance, the District of Columbia, just instituted a paid family leave program, and my wife took advantage of that. She works for the city. And seeing how a family operates, I don't understand how it would without this, with us just having half the income. And me continuing to go to work from the minute my son was born.
I have a friend who was a school teacher in Los Angeles, moved to Virginia, had her kid, and was like thinking about going back to work for the school system. And she realized that her family would actually save more money if she did not work and stayed at home rather than – they couldn't make it work with the daycare.
Right, because you – because first of all, daycare,
there's so many considerations.
It's hard to get in the first place, daycare or nanny. And then you have to be making enough money that it's worth it to go back to work if you're going to pay people to take care of your kids. So it's a difficult situation.
Yeah, the idea that having a baby could put you like upside down like that income-wise, I don't think a lot of people understand that that's like just something that happens to normal people in their normal lives.
Well, and also –
this isn't a policy about like benefiting elites. It's not a policy that's about, you know, feathering the nest of some, you know, industry. You know, it's literally just a policy about the logic of real life and real people living that real life and how to make it work. Not
well.
The
baby formula industrial complex
probably thinks
differently about this, Jason.
I joked about moochers at the top, but this really isn't about moochers. It's not about giveaways. It's about making things a tiny bit easier.
It's also about just biology and the human race needing to propagate.
But, I mean, I think it also has something to do with workplace norms and workplace discrimination as well. Because if you normalize the idea that, that men and women should take off, you know, months, basically, when they have a child and get paid for it, then I think you will see you will lower the amount of punishment that women often face in the workforce for having a children. Women often lose their jobs preemptively when they have a kid because people, they're sexist employers, just don't think they're going to be as dedicated to their job anymore once they have a kid. And you see people occasionally actually saying this, out in public saying, well, you know, once women have kids, there was a hedge fund manager who said this at a UVA event a while back. It's like, oh man, as soon as that happens, you know, women just aren't as good at their jobs. They just don't care anymore. And so women end up losing their jobs preemptively.
They don't have 22 hours to nearly kill themselves from my hedge fund. Yeah.
Or face, you know, once they have a kid, they often don't get promoted. If they don't get outright fired, they don't get promoted. They don't get the same types of opportunities because people are like, oh, well, now you're just a mom. But if we normalize the idea that people are not just employees, they are also moms and dads and that they need to have time to spend with their family, to have a functional family, and that's normal. Then I think you would see less of this bullshit sexism in other arenas.
Well, so here's what's going to happen. The Democrats believe they have a popular issue, and to this point, they had been on this more aggressively, the Obama administration and congressional Democrats, since last year. It hasn't received a ton of attention because it's been not a rider on must-pass legislation, and they haven't controlled the House, and they still don't. But now it's getting major megaphone treatment from Democratic leadership in the White House and in Congress. What will Republicans do? They've been quiet about it, but the legislation that is the proposed solution to this guarantees workers paid leave.
Right.
It's financed by a 1% tax on payrolls. So there you have it. It's going to be, job killing. Tax hike, and I predict that is where the Republicans will dig their trench.
Do they have an alternative plan to deal with the logic?
They do have some stuff that tinkers at the margins. For instance, the Republican House kept pushing this bill that would allow businesses to pay you in time instead of extra pay for overtime. So instead of working, getting extra pay for overtime, you could just take time off and work from home. It really doesn't respond to the situation when you've got like rampant wage theft in this country. So they haven't developed their policy response too much, but I do predict they'll dig in and we'll have a trench warfare that we're familiar with.
But in the meantime, there are things the federal government can and is doing, right? I mean,
there's this executive order to give federal workers 6 weeks. Which is, kind of measly. It's what the White House had been doing. Sam Stein actually had to pry this information out of them last year because they were advocating for paid family leave and, to our knowledge, did not offer any. So they do offer 6 weeks, which isn't really that much. I mean, that's just enough time for a woman to physically recover from childbirth. I mean, that's the bare minimum. So it's not all that impressive, except that the president's doing it by fiat, I guess, instead of begging Congress to do it. But it's not a whole lot of time.
Well, I mean, well, it could prompt conversations, right? I mean, there if federal workers get this benefit, you might find that to compete for better employees, more companies like ours would offer more generous benefits of their own, right?
Right.
Absolutely, and that's the idea. It's to help the whole U.S. workforce and employers lurch in the direction.
And
of,
this has worked before.
More liberal policy.
You know, I think a lot of people sort of they take it. They see Obama issuing these kind of executive orders, things that just affect employees of the federal government, like raising minimum wage among people or offering them benefits. And what I see happening is that Obama's in a place where he's never maybe there's a time in his first 2 years of Congress where he might have had a favorable Congress to do this kind of thing. Even then, I don't think that every Democrat – I think there have been a lot of people in his Democratic supermajority who are too squishy. But there's never been really a time where Obama could be like, Congress, give me a nationwide minimum wage pass. Give me a nationwide paid and family medical leave thing.
Right.
He doesn't have the thing to do that. But he has an arena which he can operate in. What we've seen, I think, in the past is that – he's made a decision, started a conversation about it, and you see pockets all around the country following suit.
That happened with states and the minimum wage.
Yeah, it has. Sure. It has. It's interesting. It's interesting because people kind of conceive like the president as a guy who has like these kind of like magic powers of persuasion and bully pulpit, can order people to do what he wants. Mm-hmm. And really, it's not like that. You know, the political science term is that a way of putting it is that a president can like facilitate change in a favorable environment. I think there was a favorable environment for minimum wage increase, and he just simply catalyzed something, got a conversation started, added creatine to the scene, and you see pockets around the country following suit. It's becoming more and more popular, more and more viable, and perhaps this is the kind of issue that, once again, is sort of like quietly leading within this tiny area that he has control over. Might be able to spur action outside government.
He also forces Republicans to make a choice now that they're in charge of both chambers of Congress. You know, when Democrats are in control, Ben Nelson or Mary Landrieu could just say, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm going to be a moderate and just kind of be a pain in the butt on this because that's what I do. And now they can't do that because Republicans are in those seats. Republicans are tasked with having to govern.
And there are fewer Ben Nelsons in the Democratic caucus now.
And Republicans may well shoot this down. I think they will. But they will at least have to be – they'll have to take political responsibility
for
that.
Their fingerprints will be on the trigger of the gun that shoots this down.
I got a piece that we got to roll, guys.
That's a great way to end it. Thanks for joining us, Zach and Arthur.
Miss you guys already. See you next week.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta, Chris Gentilviso, and Adriana Usero. I'm Jason Linkins. This week we were joined by Huffington Post senior politics reporter Arthur Delaney, Zach Carter, and Amanda Turkle. So That Happened is now available on iTunes. Please check us out in the iTunes store and find the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we miss you already.